Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Doyle Preheim of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale about the upcoming concert of New Mexico composers. Right now, I would like to welcome Sandy Benson. She is the translator of the book Tales of the Golden Corpse, Tibetan Folk Tales. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we had you on not too long ago for the Festival of Women Authors here in Santa Fe, but we wanted to have you on again, first of all, to talk at more length about Tales of the Golden Corpse, because these Tibetan folk tales are incredibly rich and fascinating, and also some of them are pretty gruesome, so we thought we would read one and have a nice pre-Halloween show.
Yeah, that's my favorite part about the story, is how gory and scary they can be.
And what's so funny is when you have we Americans in a place like Santa Fe have sort of these stereotypes about Tibet as this peaceful place with a lovely Buddhist tradition where everybody's a vegetarian. That's and not here, what you find in these tales.
No, here you have Chang drinking.
What is Chang? Some kind of wine?
It's a barley rice beer. It's fermented barley. And there's a lot of Chang drinking. There's a lot of Sampa eating. There are, you know, just incredible tricks played on everybody there. They make so much fun of the Tibetan culture itself, you know.
Is that what they're doing? They're actually making fun of their own culture these stories?
Well, I think they are. I mean, they're witty, they're funny, they're silly, as much as they can be scary. And to me, it very much like being in the Tibetan community where I was teaching for several years in India in the refugee community. They were just such a wide range of behavior, but overall, I felt that there was a humor and kind of a trickster quality about the community. That clearly comes out in these tales, which are quite secular.
So how did you get into the whole Tibetan community and learning Tibetan, translating Tibetan? This is something that most Americans never even dream of doing.
Well, it was something that just happened when I was quite young, about 14 years old. I was fascinated with languages, and I wanted to know more about the origin of language and came across Sanskrit and then found this book on Tibetan yoga and the secret doctrines, which sounded quite mysterious. And I was fascinated by the description of the gods. They're so colorful. They have many different hands that are holding many different tools, all these implements that they can use to tame the mind and control the mind and to tame our own innate sense towards negativity and suffering. So some of the gods' names were like 13 letters long, and somehow that just fascinated me, and it started what has become a lifelong fascination with the Tibetan culture in general.
And so you actually learned Sanskrit as a teenager?
Well, I would look at the letters. The letters themselves, the characters, were fascinating. They have little hats and tails and tops to them. They're very complicated, but I was kind of riveted by them. And so, no, I couldn't really read them. I would, you know, try and sound out the words, but, you know, I wasn't even anywhere close, I'm sure, because I didn't have a teacher until many, many years later, you know, when I was in my late 30s, when I finally sat in front of a Tibetan teacher. So there was a long gap there.
It's interesting that you say that these gods with all these different hands have tools to tame the mind, because, of course, taming the mind is part of the meditation tradition that we associate with Tibetan Buddhism.
It is, but it's as opposed to what some people might readily know about meditation, is that it's a very peaceful process. It can, in Tibet,
I think only non-meditators think that meditation is a peaceful process.
Exactly.
As a long-term meditator, I can tell you personally that it's no fun at all.
Oh, you've experienced the monkey mind. Well, yes, the Tibetans felt there were many, many tools for all the different types of personality to use to try and get to know the nature of reality. That's the fundamental principle behind it. So, and the process is not always peaceful. Sometimes you have to cut. Sometimes you have to burn. Sometimes, you know, you have to really work hard to separate your the feeling that you have to suffer. And
so these Tibetan folktales somehow indirectly deal with some of those issues?
Yes, I think they are. They're like secular teaching tales. They teach children examples of what happens when you're greedy or what happens when you don't tell the truth. But it's not particularly linear path. Sometimes the greedy do win, but along the way.
And as in real life.
Yes. and so there are twists and turns that are that make the adventures in the stories and make the stories so mysterious. You really don't know where you're headed when you follow the path of the story. Sometimes there are stories within other stories. And that's true, too, when you're sitting and meditating, that you'll be carried off into little corners of this thought and that thought and this feeling. And so in that sense, it's like going on a wild ride through the mind of, you know, the culture.
Where did you gather these stories, and where are they from in the first place?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. The stories themselves are set within a frame. That means that there's something that happens over and over again at the beginning and the end of each story. That frame of a young boy who happened to kill 7 sorcerers in the master's cave, and in order to atone for this dastardly deed that he committed, even though he was saving the master from the sorcerers, he has to go do something for the master, which is to go retrieve this amazing magical corpse who's living in a cemetery many miles away.
Now, that's interesting, first of all. The young person saves the master, but he's still punished.
Yes.
For the deed that he does in saving the master.
I think it's fascinating. There's a line in the introductory story where the master, when he sees it, it's a situation where the sorcerers have turned into a series of different animals and birds and things, and they end up as 7 dead scorpions on the floor of the cave. But right after they die, they turn back into sorcerers, and the master is going, oh, this is an immeasurably terrible deed that has been committed here. And the young boy says, I'm so sorry. What can I do to be forgiven? And, you know, I'm so full of remorse. And the master says, well, I don't know how useful remorse is, but you must redeem yourself. So there's a separation, and that's the example kind of the teaching that can sneak in here.
Very interesting. And so these characters actually appear at the beginning and end of all the separate tales in the book.
Yes, well, the tales are actually told by the magical corpse. The young boy, you know, wanting to... the master actually tells the young boy that if you do bring this corpse to me, then all the poverty in the world will disappear. Everything will be wonderful. And I'm not really sure how that works, but nevertheless, it's also thought that anyone that hears the stories will also be experience liberation.
So very interesting. When one has the suspicion that this endeavor may not have succeeded given the way the world is right now.
One would think. The boy does get to the corpse. He does convince the corpse to hop in his magical bag and, you know, and be taken back to the master. But there's a rule. The boy cannot say a word. And, of course, the corpse wants to trip him up and starts telling all these fantastic stories. So that's the part of the frame that happens where the corpse is telling this amazing adventure story and the boy can't help himself and says, oh, what a wonderful story. And the corpse disappears, flying off back into the sky all the way back to the caves. So over and over again, we get to hear a story.
So these stories come from a particular region of Tibet?
Oh, well, yes. Okay, so the frame is found in an ancient collection of Sanskrit tales, actually, in 4th century BC, I mean, hundreds of years ago. And it's thought that the stories, along with Buddhism, came from India into Tibet around the 8th to 11th century, and that these stories were just told to entertain children, and they were told by the nomads and the teachers and the merchants that came. So along over all these years, the stories have spread all throughout Asia, actually. They're quite well known in Asia, you know, throughout China, Mongolia, Burma, everywhere in Asia. So
I imagine there's a lot of different versions of the same stories as well.
Yes, I started to investigate that, and it was fascinating. There are the stories like get thrown up in the air like a big salad and come down. They're all tossed around so that you've got some characters doing what other characters did in other stories at the beginning and the end. It's just a big mess, but the reoccurring the tricksters, the witches, the devils, all those characters are the same. Well, actually, they're in these stories, they're quite a bit more Tibetan, because the source collection that I worked from, and also the Tibetans that I talked to, got the Tibetan version of the story. So this collection holds more of the Tibetan cultural items and beliefs.
And what are some of those specifics? What, for example, about the way people live, the activities that they do?
Yes, well, you've got funerals, you've got weddings. You've got all the different objects that you see in Tibetan culture. They're eating meat features heavily. like I said before, drinking chang, using prayer beads, prayer wheels, seeing coming across prayer flags flapping in the wind. All these things that you would see in Tibet.
And burning. The landscape.
The landscape, they're always crossing endless amounts of high desert grasslands and, you know, climbing mountains and coming across castles. There aren't quite so many castles in Tibet now. Yeah, it's very familiar territory when to me from my travels in Tibet. When I read through these stories, I felt like I was, you know, continuing my experience of that.
We're talking to Sandy Benson, the translator of the book Tales of the Golden Corpse, Tibetan Folk Tales. And we're going to read Sandy is going to read one of these stories as kind of a Halloween warm-up right now. Gets a little gruesome, ladies and gentlemen, if you have young children in the car. I don't think it's that bad. I mean, these are meant to be read to children.
Yes, they are. They are. And yeah, it's kind of a very revealing in these stories how they can be very violent and also very tender. There's such a range in these stories, and I think at first glance someone might think, oh my goodness, this isn't very politically appropriate, or, you know, in today's context of how children maybe are allowed to read stories. But these are raw and real and come out of deep from the culture and show all aspects of the human condition and what happens when we get greedy or, you know, get into trouble. And so this is, I think they're a tremendous amount of fun and very entertaining.
You also have commentaries on the story at the back of each story at the back of the book. Tell us a little bit before you start reading it, the name of the story and the origins that you know about it.
With the Masang Yaru Kadra is the story that I'd like to read. And in the commentary, it describes that a couple of things about the tales. Let's see if I can put my hand on it. Well, I wrote the commentaries because I wanted to provide the biggest possible window into Tibetan culture. And so each story taps into different aspects of the culture, whether it's astrology or medicine or the principle of the Bodhisattva of compassion, learning about that deity. There were so many things that are brought up in the stories that I wanted to be able to speak to those in particular. And with Masanyo Kadra, the bull, Masang, follows a maiden up a ladder of roses to heaven, and we'll hear more about that later. But there is an ancient Tibetan legend where the first seven generations of kings arrived and departed from mountaintops of their kingdoms on a rope that reached all the way to heaven. There's also an old Tibetan tale that says that in the beginning of time, Tibet was ruled by the nine Masang brothers, who were extraordinarily powerful, semi-divine beings, who were the first to deliver weapons to Tibetans. And they also help safeguard travelers, and they're good at increasing a gambler's luck.
Okay. So go ahead and let's dive into the story. These stories start once upon a time.
Once upon a time, at the edge of a deep valley, a man lived alone with his cow. All his milk, cheese, and butter came from the cow, but he still had to hunt wild animals for meat. One year, the cow bore a calf, but to the man's shock, he saw that although it was born with a bull's head and tail, the rest of its body was human. Being a very superstitious man, he grabbed his iron bow and arrow, preparing to kill the calf, when it suddenly spoke. "Don't kill me. Feed me. I'll be your faithful son, and I will return the favor in the future." The man didn't dare kill an animal that could speak. Also, he was lonely, living in the valley without a son of his own. So he put down the bow and arrow and decided to keep the calf. He gave it an unusual name, Masanyaru Kadra. He fed the calf plenty of milk, butter, and, because he was part human, many fine morsels of meat. Masanyaru Kadra grew quickly, and before long, he was as big and strong as a bull could be. One day, Masanyaru Kadra told his father that in order to repay his father's kindness, he should be allowed to hunt. The man agreed to let his son leave home, so the next day the bull made his way through the thick forest where he met a black man whose face was as dark as the bark of tree he was leaning against. "Who are you?" Masanyaru Kadra asked the man. "I was born the strong man of the forest. I can go anywhere with you as your friend," said the black-faced man. So together they went on their way. Soon they came to a grassland where they met another man whose face was almost as blue as the sky. "Who are you?" Masanyaru Kadra asked the blue-faced man. "I was born the strong man of the grassland. I too can be your friend," said the blue man. So the three of them traveled together. It wasn't long before they arrived at a big rock. The bull saw a man whose face was as pale as the rock he was sitting on. "And who are you?" the bull asked the pale-faced man. "I was born the strong man of the rock. I too will be your friend," the pale-faced man replied. So the four of them continued on together. After many hours of walking, they arrived at a very large two-story house in a deep rock canyon. On the ground floor was a barn where several wild animals had been living. Above that, supported by a thick wooden pillars, was the main room, a very large kitchen. It appeared that the animals had been staying there for a while, but the owner of the house was nowhere to be found. The four friends decided to stay at the house. After some discussion, they agreed that every day one man would stay at home to prepare the meals, while the others would hunt for animals. Now, on the first day, the strong man of the forest stayed home. He was churning the milk and watching a pot of meat boiling on the stove when the kitchen door opened slowly. "Oh, you work so hard," said an old woman. Turning to look at the woman, he saw she was tiny, her body only the size of his hand. Yet she was loaded down with a very large bundle, just like a mule. "Oh, a boy like you, home alone, cooking the meat," she said to the man. "Give me a taste of that meat and yogurt." He offered the old woman some food. She took a bite of meat and tasted the yogurt and then walked out the door struggling under her heavy load. The strong man returned to the kitchen only to find all the food had disappeared. He searched everywhere in the house. Finally, he went outside, and after finding a horseshoe, he set about making many hoof prints all around the house. Then he rushed inside the house, gathered all the arrows he could find, went back outside, and shot the arrows into the roof of the house until they were sticking out all around the roof. Well, it was dusk by the time the three hunters returned with their kill of the day, and noticing no food had been prepared for their evening meal, they asked the strong man, "Where is the food you made for us today?" "Today, close to 100 thieves on horseback came and stole all the food, and then they beat me till I couldn't move," said the strong man of the forest. "Go outside and see for yourself." Stepping outside, they saw the hoof prints all around the house and arrows sticking out all along the roof. The three friends believed everything the strong man of the forest had said. On the second day, the strong man of the grassland stayed at home while the others went hunting. Now, everything that happened the day before happened again, but this time the hoof prints of the strong man of the grassland made outside the house were those of a yak. When the others returned, the strong man of the grassland told them many thieves riding yaks had come and stolen all the food from the house. On the third day, the strong man of the rock stayed at home. Everything that happened the day before happened again, but this time the hoof prints were those of a mule. When the others returned, the strong man of the rock told them that thieves riding mules this time had taken all the food from the house. The following day, the three men went hunting, and this time it was the bull, Masang Yarukadra, who stayed at home waiting. Horns alert, tail switching from side to side, the bull was ready for anything. While he was churning the milk and boiling the meat, the little old woman returned to the house. "Oh, now a strange person like you stays here. Give an old woman a taste of yogurt and meat," demanded the old woman. The bull thought to himself, so this is what happened when the others were staying at home. I wonder what will happen if I give this old woman a taste of our food. He quickly grabbed a needle and, turning his back on the woman, punched many little holes in a water bucket. "The corpse must be cut into pieces before being fed to the birds. All four limbs must work to take care of the body. Isn't there a saying like this? Before I give you a taste of yogurt and meat, you must take this bucket and fetch some water," said the bull, handing her the bucket. The old woman couldn't refuse, so she put down her bundle and set off to get the water. Now, after she left, the bull opened her bundle, and inside he found a leather rope, a pair of iron tongs, and an iron hammer. He removed these things and replaced them with an old wool rope, a pair of wooden tongs, and a wooden hammer. Then he tied the bundle shut, just as it had been tied before. The old woman returned and said to the bull, "I went to get the water, but your bucket doesn't hold water. Now give me that taste of food." "You couldn't even get a little bit of water?" asked the bull. "You useless old feedback. I'm not going to give you a taste of anything." The old woman was furious, gnashing her teeth wildly, hands clenched into her fists. Her face curled into a fierce scowl, and her body suddenly seemed to grow very powerful, though she was still a tiny woman. "This house and everything in it belongs to me," she growled. "And you don't even give me a taste of your food? Now let's see who's more powerful." With that, she took the old rotten rope from her bundle and tied up the bull. She pinched his body with the wooden tongs and beat him with her wooden hammer. But the wooden tongs and wooden hammer quickly broke. In fact, the beating hadn't hurt the bull at all. Struggling against the rope, he broke free. He grabbed the leather rope, tied up the old woman, and pinched her body with the iron tongs. And then he beat her with the iron hammer until she was barely alive. After that, he carried her downstairs and hung her from a pillar beneath the kitchen. Then he walked back up the stairs to the kitchen to finish making the yogurt and boiling the meat. Soon, the three hunters returned. "Have you had a difficult time while we were away?" the hunters asked the bull. "Oh, you three told lies. You are all cowards," said the bull to the others. "Where are the thieves? Today I caught a thief, and I've hung her body from a pillar downstairs. I'll show you. Follow me." They all followed him, but when they arrived, they saw nothing but a pool of blood just below the pillar. A small trickle of blood made a path across the back of the barn and outside, leading to a small opening in the side of a big rocky mountain. Peering down into the dark crevice, they saw a golden pillar glistening in the middle of a cave. From far below came an eerie groaning sound. No one dared enter the cave. "Tie a rope around my waist, and I will go down," said the brave Masangyaru Kadra. The three friends did as he said, tied the rope around his waist, and lowered him into the cave. The bull was halfway down into the cave when off to one side he saw a huge room filled with gold, silver, silks, and many other precious objects. And beside a pile of gold lay the witch. Blood was still flowing from her mouth and nose, but she was finally dead. Placing the many precious objects into a box, the bull wrapped a strong rope around the box and called to his friends to lift it out of the cave. Lifting the box from the cave, the three friends said, "If we help Masangyaru Kadra out of the cave, we'll have to share the precious gems and gold with him." So as soon as the three friends pulled the box out of the cave, they ran away, leaving the bull at the bottom of the cave. The bull soon realized he'd been tricked by his friends. He looked around desperately for a way out of the cave, but all he found were three peach pits. Setting the pits on the cave floor, he sprinkled them with water before falling asleep. Without knowing how long he had slept, he woke to find three fully grown peach trees in the cave. He quickly climbed one of the trees, reaching the mouth of the cave easily. And picking up his iron bow and arrow, he started off towards the big house in the forest. The bull hadn't gone very far before he came to a spring of clear, cold running water. And beside the spring sat a beautiful woman, filling her water bucket. She slowly walked towards a rose-covered ladder, which she then began climbing into the sky. Surprised but curious, the bull decided to follow the young woman up the ladder. He climbed the flowered ladder for a long time until he finally arrived in heaven. The bull went directly to the king's palace, where he was greeted warmly. "Masangyaru Kadra," said the king, "it's lucky for us that you have come. We, the gods of heaven, have been battling the devils. We have no fear of the devils we fight. Tomorrow, come to the battlefield and see what happens. In the morning, the white yaks, the gods, drive away all the black yaks to the far side of the field. And in the afternoon, the black yaks, the devils, drive the white yaks back over to the other side of the field. And in the middle of the black yaks is one very big black yak with a beam of light shining from his forehead. He is the king of the devils. Now you must aim carefully at the devil's bright spot with your bow and arrow, and be sure to hit this target. If you can do this, the gods will win, and all disease and suffering in the world will end." The next day, accompanied by many gods and goddesses, the bull went to the battlefield, and in the middle of all the black yaks, he saw the bright light shining from between the eyes of one huge black yak. The bull drew his arrow, aimed carefully, and shot the Devil King. Suddenly, a great roar rose from the herd as the frightened black yaks, the devil's soldiers, ran away. The bull returned to the palace to appear before the king of the gods. The king was extremely pleased to hear the good news. "You have our deepest gratitude. Today we have won. I must warn you, though, that when you shot the Devil King, you seriously wounded him, but he did not die. Returning to the human realm could be dangerous for you. You should stay here in heaven with us," said the God King. "I will not stay. I must go back to earth to return a favor to my father," explained the bull. "I must also find my three very greedy friends." To show his gratitude, the king gave the bull some precious jewels and 5 grains of barley. "Then as you go," said the king, "if the devil causes you any trouble, just toss these 5 barley seeds into the sky and I will defend you. When you arrive in the land of humans, Pray to the precious jewels I have given you, and they will grant your every desire. And so the bull started on his way back home. The bull hadn't traveled very far before he took a wrong turn in the road and arrived at the gate of the Devil King's home. Suddenly, the Devil King's wife was at the gate holding a ball of flaming iron. A blast of fire roared from her mouth. The bull quickly tossed the 5 barley grains into the sky. Seconds later, a huge iron chain rattled down from the clouds. The bull grabbed the chain and began climbing as fast as he could, but the devil's wife rushed toward the chain and threw the fireball at the bull, almost searing his body in half. In a flash, the king of the gods unfurled his long braid of hair down from the sky and swept the bull away, clasping tightly to the braid. The bull sailed high into the night sky, where he became the famous 7 stars you can see every night. And at this point in the story, Deichu Tsangbo asked, "After all that, the king of the devils, did he or didn't he die?" "Plah! Ronundipchen, the corpse, escapes again."
Sandra Benson is translator of Tales of the Golden Corpse, Tibetan Folk Tales. And what an amazing story. And we don't really have time to talk about it too much more, but a lot of loose ends are not tied up in this story. The greedy friends, we never see them again. We never see whether he gets to go and return the favor to his father.
Exactly.
But there's witches and devils and all sorts of things.
And in almost every story, you never know when the young Tibetan boy who's carrying this corpse is going to speak. So you don't know when you're going to be cut off. Some of the stories, you get some little bit of resolution, but there, in many of the stories, you're left wondering.
Sandra Benson, thank you so much for being here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Doyle Preheim. He is the musical director of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale. And coming up on Sunday, the 9th of November, there's going to be a concert, which is a showcase of New Mexico composers. Welcome, Doyle.
Nice to be here, Mary Charlotte.
Glad to have you back. So, New Mexico composers, what was the inspiration for this concert?
Well, two things converged. I had the idea that it'd be nice to do a program of music from our state, and I've lived here 5 years, and I've learned to know some of the composers personally. And so I was thinking about a New Mexico composer concert when, at the same time, a member of our choir, John Michael Luther, said, how about I would compose a piece based on the life of Esther Martinez from the San Juan Pueblo? She had been killed in a tragic car accident shortly before that. So these two ideas converged, and we have come up with this program, Music from the Land of Enchantment, a showcase of New Mexico composers.
Are these 20th and 21st century composers, or does our composing tradition go back further than that?
Well, these are all living composers. I'm sure the tradition goes back further, but it just so happens that on this concert, everyone who is represented is still with us.
And so how did you choose them?
Well, I looked at a large number of possible pieces, and it turned out that the first half of the program fell into place with a Native American theme, including pieces by Michael Maldon, Conrad DeYoung, John Michael Luther, and we're also featuring a Native American flutist, Ronald Roybal. He has played in many Santa Fe venues and is quite well known in the area. Anyway, the first half of the program will be Native American themes. And the second half of the program is more eclectic. You know, as a conductor of a choir, you have the opportunity to choose the music that strikes you as being the most interesting and most beautiful. So it's more of a compilation of a variety of pieces.
Why don't we hear some music? What would you like to play first?
Let's begin with Introduction of the Child of the Cosmos by Michael Maldon. It's a setting of a Omaha Indian tribe text, which is being performed on this recording by the Sangre de Cristo Chorale of some years ago. Thank you.
And so tell us a little bit about the text of that piece.
Well, it was evidently an original text or poem of the Omaha Indian tribe, which and the poem talks about welcoming a new birth, a new child into the cosmos. And it's, in a sense, it's a bit of a prayer that... You know, the cosmos would care for this child through its many various phases of life.
Is that a poem that was sung or spoken every time a new child was born?
I can't answer that question, but it's possible in that tradition, yes.
So one of the pieces on the program was composed for Esther Martinez.
Yes, Song of Blue Water by John Michael Luther. And Blue Water is the Tewa name for Esther Martinez, and hence the name of the song, Song of Blue Water. And it's a wonderful piece that, that's been written for the choir. It includes a soprano soloist, a native flute, a native drum, and rattles and bells. John Luther has tried to incorporate Native American musical ideas and themes into the program of this piece. And the text is... from various sources, actually, the song incorporates a song or a melody that Esther Martinez herself wrote, and it talks about how she was influenced in her life by the elders, by her mother, and in a sense is a calling out of Esther Martinez's spirit. Very interesting piece, especially with the inclusion of the Native American flute, and Ronald Roybal plays that so, so beautifully.
We're talking to Doyle Preheim, the musical director of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale, and the upcoming concert of New Mexico composers is on Sunday, the 9th of November at 2:30 at the Santa Maria de la Paz Church in Santa Fe. So should we play another piece?
Yes, we could listen to another interesting song called The Rune of Hospitality.
Now, rune is spelled R-U-N-E.
Yes, the gift of hospitality, the spirit of hospitality.
Now, aren't runes those little stone divinatory Viking things?
I think you're right. In this case, there are no stones left unturned, perhaps. But yes, it's an unusual use of the word, but it's from the Gaelic tradition, and Alf Hocum, the composer of this piece, lives in Corrales, New Mexico, so a neighbor of ours. The piece is written for chorus and guitar, which is a bit of an unusual combination because the guitar is a rather soft instrument, unless you amplify it, but I don't think that's the intention of the composer. So one of the challenges we have is to balance the guitar against a choir of 48 singers.
You don't have an electric guitar on a big amplifier.
No, we do not. Patrick Burns is a local guitarist who will be performing with us. He teaches guitar at Santa Fe High School. And let's take a listen.
And we're talking to Doyle Preheim of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale about the upcoming concert, Music from the Land of Enchantment, a showcase of New Mexico composers. We want to be sure to play a piece that was based on the words of Chief Seattle.
Mm-hmm. This we know. Earth was not made for the man. Man was made for the earth. Setting by Conrad DeYoung, currently lives in Santa Fe. He had a career as an academic teaching theory, music theory and composition at the University of Wisconsin in River Falls. This piece incorporates piano as the accompaniment with a choir, and I think we should take a listen.
Thank you.
And so New Mexico composers. This is an exciting program. Also, there's some religious music. St. Thomas Aquinas, words from the 13th century, music from the 20th or 21st century.
Exactly. A setting by Linda Rice Beck, who is also a Santa Fe composer. O Sacrum Convivium. It's a beautiful setting of this liturgical text. Another favorite of the choir, I think, is Be Music Night. By Bradley Ellingbow. Bradley Ellingbow had conducted the choir for one semester, has served on our board, is professor at UNM. The poem by Kenneth Patchen, a very, very moving poem.
And so you have composers who are former directors and former singers or even current singers of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale.
Yes, indeed. Bradley Ellingbow is one. Also, Mary Bederick has conducted the choir for one semester. David Jeunesse.
How do you get into the choir? Is this a rigorous audition process?
It's an audition process, but we're an amateur group, so I would say that the audition process is not too rigorous, and I'd be glad to hear anyone who is interested in singing with us.
Really? Are you always looking for new singers?
Of course.
Is it a balance of male and female voices?
We are almost 50% male, 50% female, yes.
Ah, just like the population.
Yes.
And so then you, if somebody is maybe gifted but not very much practiced, you train them in singing?
Well, they would get some wonderful experience in the choir, yes. Some of them take voice lessons, and they do have all kinds of opportunity to better their singing skills.
Doyle Preheim is the musical director of the Sangre de Cristo Chorale, and once again, Music from the Land of Enchantment, a showcase of New Mexico composers, is on Sunday, the 9th of November at 2:30 in the afternoon at the Santa Maria de la Paz Church, which is in Santa Fe, actually pretty much across the street from the Santa Fe Community College. And for tickets and information, people can call 455-3707. And is that where they also call if they want to find out more about singing?
They might call my number,
which is
474-7227.
Doyle Preheim, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org by email or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen. It's a podcast. You just click on Listen Now and you can hear it. And all that thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. So stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the studios of KSFR, my name is Mary Charlotte. And the equipment that's usually in the Santa Fe Baking Company is being serviced right now, which is why we are at the studios. And we hope to be back in the wonderful convivial atmosphere of the Santa Fe Baking Company very soon. Hasta la vista. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.